Contrary to popular wishes, we haven't all been frozen in carbonite and used as doorstops in Abu Simbel. This is episode number 4 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Mike Saunders.
And I'm Andrew Gregory.
And in this episode, we're talking about Jim Zemlin. He wants United Linux front for netbooks. How can we help people who have a hard time switching to Linux from Windows? And should proprietary software be easy to install? Remember, we release a new podcast every 2 weeks on tuxradar.com. Also publishing news, features and more. Make sure you bookmark it. And of course, it's all brought to you by Linux Format. You can subscribe today at tinyurl.com/podcastlxf. Top story in the news this month is, of course, CodeWeaver's plan to support DirectX 10 on Linux, hopefully this year, in Wine. What do you think, guys?
Does that mean you'll be able to run Grand Theft Auto 4 on Linux? Which is probably what everybody's going to be asking.
Is that DirectX 10?
I don't know.
Good work, Mike.
Yes.
I think given that it runs on XP, I believe, I think it's probably DirectX 9.
Right.
They're not saying they've got flawless DirectX 9 support already. They're just saying it's good enough and they can move on a little bit and try some more.
CodeWeavers are the people who do Sudoku, is that right?
No, it's Crossover.
Crossover Games.
And DirectX is something to do with graphics.
Yes.
So this is going to make games better on Linux.
It does.
Awesome.
Yeah, well, it makes them run on Linux, which is therefore better. Because right now, they don't run at all. Well, a lot of them don't run at all.
So what are some of the AAA PC gaming titles that use DirectX 10?
Well, that's actually an interesting point, because a lot of companies have been doing DX10 versions and DX9 versions, because you can't get DirectX 10 on XP.
Not even through some sort of hackery, jiggery pokery?
No, it's not possible. So games, I think, like Lost Planet, were releasing both versions simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And this is a very interesting point, because what it means is, if Crossover Games gets DirectX 10 support, it will have it before XP, which I think is fantastic.
Ah, and with people not wanting to upgrade to Vista, then Linux exactly. Becomes a better gaming platform. I think my head's just exploded.
Yeah, well, it's Microsoft's plan coming back to bite them, basically. They don't want to do it on XP.
Ha ha.
They claim they can't do it on XP. It's not possible.
They can't. Just they like can't they couldn't it. Remove Internet Explorer they from can't. Windows. Yeah.
They can't do it. It's not possible, they claim.
I've not kept on top of it, but does DirectX 10 really offer some advantages over 9? I mean, are games better when they use 10 now?
You've got Shader Model 4, which lets you do some fancy effects. Right. And the thing is, all GPUs now, all graphics cards are designed for DirectX 10 or higher. What that means is they've got something called a unified shader model. Just so you know, it means pixel shaders and vertex shaders out the window now. It's just unified shaders so that the graphics card can make better use of them.
Right. It's so just that I remember when it was first released, there were very few improvements that DirectX 10 offered.
Yeah.
So will Tetris run better with DirectX 10?
Yeah.
Cool.
It may now run. So it runs better, which is a good thing.
I think this is obviously a direction that Crossover has to take. Probably for other software they need to make compatible. Probably there's lots of Microsoft Office applications that require DirectX 10 in some way. And they need to bring compatibility anyway.
What for the Easter eggs inside Excel?
Yeah, for the Quake 3D engine hidden inside Excel.
Yeah, possibly. It's just great to see them biting at the heels of Microsoft in a way.
Yeah.
And they're very, very close. I mean, so many games, even today, are released using DirectX 9.
Yeah, yeah.
And that means if they get 100% DirectX 9, they'll all just work. Nearly all the top games will just work, which is fantastic.
And also, Jeremy White is very confident about DirectX 9 compatibility in Crossover, which is great as well.
Yeah, did you see his blog post? He talked about Crossover Games 8, or Crossover 8, basically, in general, what they're trying to work on right now. And it's fantastic. They're looking at, you know, making 2007 Office work flawlessly. That's one of their main targets.
Yeah.
They want Photoshop CS3.
Good lord.
Which is, it's pretty much bang up to date. There's CS4, obviously, but, you know, CS3's most people at this point. They want Quicken 2009 to work, and that's all coming out this year, they believe. And after that, it's all DirectX 10 stuff. So they're really pushing ahead, which is fantastic. And also, don't let this one slip away. What they're doing is, behind the scenes, lots and lots of little fixes. And that means, finally, we can say, hey, try running it on Wine, and it may actually work.
It may be faster than on Linux as well. Like Firefox.
Like Firefox, yes. Yes, it's true. But it means that things are more likely to just work. Even if they're not on the list, you can try them and see what happens, which is really, really, really cool. Also in the news, Jim Zemlin and the netbook, he's been saying that it's time to shift the focus away from software and towards services for netbooks, meaning that we've been losing our market share, Linux, because we've been focusing too much on the OS, which lets Microsoft take over What do you reckon, guys?
Well, I guess Jim's point is that there isn't a Wii, that Linux was used because it was a cheap option on the original netbooks. There was no kind of coherent movement behind it. It was just used and stuck on those things. And I guess what he's saying is that now's the time that we need to come together as a community or as Linux and make it more effective as a single front.
But can that actually happen, though? You know, it's if there's nobody in charge to say this is going to be the standard netbook distro, Ubuntu netbook remix or anything like that.
Isn't this what Moblin is, what Intel is trying to achieve with Moblin?
Possibly, yeah. And, you know, there's talk of Android becoming a standard mobile Linux platform. I think it's needed, but how it can happen...
It's needed on the desktop as well.
Well, yeah, there needs to be more consistency on the desktop.
But if someone like Intel is driving it, presumably it's going to happen. We're not saying, you know, make the whole interface the same, make all the apps the same, get the basics the same so that users don't feel too lost and then go from there.
But as we've talked about in the past, that hasn't been the problem. That hasn't been why people have been taking their netbooks back to PC world. It's that they've been taking their netbooks back because it doesn't run Word and it doesn't have the start menu. I don't really see how a unified Linux is going to solve that on netbook.
Well, I think what he's trying to focus on is less about making a united distro. I think what he's trying to say is very similar to something Tim O'Reilly said a while back in his talk, The Open Source Paradigm Shift, which I'm sure we've all read, heard of. What you're saying in this talk was really important, saying that a long time ago, your choice of hardware was really important. And as PCs became standardized, hardware less important, then your operating system became important. And over time, with the rise of the internet and web applications like, you know, Google Apps and Docs, Facebook, all this kind of thing, your OS becomes less important. And actually, you can forget the OS and the web becomes important. And I think that's what Jim's trying to say. We're focusing too much on which OS you're getting. And most folks shouldn't have to care. They should just turn it on and start doing stuff with their netbook, irrespective of what OS it is. Now, obviously, you're saying that there's no start button, which is true. But they shouldn't have to worry about it. We should make it easy enough they can just get straight to the web, start doing things.
Well, I think part of the problem is if people just want to go on the web, then it really doesn't matter what you've got. It doesn't really matter what netbook you've got. But it's when people want to do more computery things, plug in a peripheral, load another piece of software. Mm. If you've got Firefox, whether it's on an E or an Aspire 1 or a Samsung, it's pretty much the same, perhaps with some performance differences.
And it's also unlikely that Microsoft is going to be quite so philanthropic with its own operating system on a netbook. You know, I'd have thought they're more likely to want to make it closely tied to their desktop operating system so that you need to have both. So they're probably going to take the opposite approach.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. moving on. Firefox had more exploits in 2008 than Internet Explorer, or Safari, or Opera.
That sounds really cool.
WTF.
Firefox had more exploits. It sounds like a dashing blade, like Zorro. it's the Scarlet Pimpernel of web browsers.
I see. Sadly, it's the wrong kind of exploits. It's the severe, dangerous, wah, 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 wah kind of exploits. It's all going wrong, or not?
That's public exploits, isn't it? True. When the IE team, and you know, there'll be plenty of diligent people at Microsoft working hard, when they find an exploit, they're not going to go and rush and put it on the internet and say, oh, hey guys, we found this hole in our code. So, you know, perhaps there have been 200 exploits, 200 holes found in IE over the last year, I don't know. But yeah, how many of them become public?
It's not a like for like comparison.
Yeah, that's rubbish. Stop. That's what's known as the no true Scotsman fallacy. How you say, oh yeah, so IE has more exploits than Firefox. Oh no, it doesn't. IE has more hidden exploits than Firefox. You keep moving the goalposts slightly to try and make Firefox look better.
Firefox could be worse. I'm just saying we can't. It's harder
to
quantify.
We can't be sure. Yeah, can't be sure. But that's an argument from silence, sadly, so we can't really take it on as read. But as far as we know, according to our numbers, Firefox had 115 in 2008 exploits compared to 32, 31, and 30 for Safari, IE, and Opera. So actually more than all the competition combined.
Which one would you feel most secure using?
Links. Dillo!
Netcat. Telnet.
Yeah, so you think it's because it's open, basically, is what you're saying?
Well, that is, you know, the whole there's more eyeballs to see the code, so people are going to see bugs. I think that comes into it. Perhaps, you know, the Firefox code base is notorious for being pretty scrappy in places, so perhaps there will be legitimate problems with it, but I don't think it's something we need to run around getting scared about yet.
Maybe it would have been more effective to compare open source rendering engines, because there are two of them. I mean, we could see which ones had the most exploits.
Well, isn't Safari based on KHTML?
Well, yeah, WebKit and whatever Firefox uses.
But Safari is open source too, ultimately, isn't it? If its rendering engine is KHTML.
WebKit. Yeah. If Apple keeps WebCore up to date, yeah.
WebKit is up to date. So, but that had fewer problems, didn't it?
Presumably. But we don't know how many exploits are down to the rendering engine and how many are down to the greater application in Firefox.
Oh, the XUL and all that business.
I think it's called Zool, isn't it?
Zool?
Yeah, like Ghostbusters.
Zool!
And that was a great Amiga game, wasn't
Zool
it?
Zool was a mediocre, I think. An Amiga platformer, yeah.
So all you need to do is SSH into Firefox and say, I am the keymaster. and you're in.
Did you play Zool in the Amiga? That was great. Yeah, was it Gremlin? Gremlin game?
Yeah, I think it was. So I wouldn't say it was a classic.
Had a sequel too.
What was that called?
Zool 2. But the flip side of all this news is Firefox's problems, the exploits Firefox reported, were of a lower rating, apparently, than Internet Explorer. For example, Internet Explorer had, I think, 6 or so in the most severe categories, whereas Firefox had none.
Yeah, if you've got 6, you know, remote root type of things, if you've got 6 exploits where somebody can totally control your box, then that's worse than 150 things where perhaps somebody can...
Is it worse?
...get your title bar information or something.
So it's 10 to 1 exchange rate, is it? For moderate to severe?
I think so.
Firefox apparently fixed them faster too.
I think we're really saying we have no idea what the consequences of these results are. I mean, we don't know.
Well, the consequences are people say, I don't want to use Firefox. That's the ultimate consequence. Yeah, yeah. They look at that and say, bloody hell, that's bad.
Who sponsored the report?
Yeah, it was a security company.
And who was paying them?
Well, also, this wasn't a report necessarily, because remember, they all go through public announcements, these sorts of things, in the US. So it's not a big company backing it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, on the face of it, it does sound like a genuine problem for the Firefox development team.
Has anybody actually been owned yet by one of these Firefox exploits, though?
Do you remember the Firefox, Gecko bug a few years ago, which was hideous, where you could set CSS font size equals 5,000 point, and it would just crash X.
Excellent.
That was fantastic. Firefox would just, Mozilla would just crash X.
So that's a denial of service attack on your X server. Yeah,
it was fantastic. Any site that let you put HTML into it using comments or whatever would just bail. It was fantastic. Potentially, I think, more damaging for the branding of Firefox as being more secure.
Okay, it's time for Hot Topic, which is where we all discuss something hot.
Really?
Wow.
Really hot.
This episode's Hot Topic is in reference to an article that was published on Computer World Online by a guy called Preston Grala. It was Living Free with Linux, and he printed a kind of a diary of his experiences of using Linux after dumping Windows over the course of a few weeks. There were 2 articles. The original article raised lots of points. Hundreds of people commented on the article, and the second article is where he went back and tried again. He had a lot of difficulties. Most of those difficulties were getting his head around some of the concepts in the Linux desktop that we've all had difficulty with. Really, the topic is, have we lost perspective? Are we losing sight of these difficulties because we all know Linux so well? What are the difficulties facing newcomers?
Well, one of the things, I was reading through the article, he mentions installing Flash on Linux.
Yeah,
and I think this is a key point, and I bore people with this on the forums, and I keep bringing it up. Everybody says installing software on Linux is easy because of package managers, but package managers just give you a snapshot of software at a particular time.
You know,
they're great when they work, but when you want to get something outside of that, you're boned because there are so many different formats.
And that's exactly the problem he had.
Yeah, he wanted to get Flash. For some reason, he couldn't get it through his normal package manager, probably because it's proprietary software, so he goes to the site.
Yeah,
and he gets a .tar.gz, and it's like, what am I going to do with this?
But before he'd even got to that point, he didn't have any conception of what a package manager is, what a software repository is, what dependencies are. He thought he could just download setup.exe, double-click on it, and he'll have Flash.
Yeah, I think setup.exe is majorly problematic on Windows because it scatters files everywhere and probes things into the registry. But it works in the sense that people think of software like a music CD. You get it out of a case and put it in, or a video, or a game you slot into your console. It's just a thing. So setup.exe is a thing. And then this idea of a package manager and dependencies is really alien. If I give you a music CD, I don't ask you to scatter it all over your house and give you 20 other CDs to put into your oven and stuff. You know, I just give you the thing as a whole. which OS X does it particularly well, I think, even though it has a lot of static linking. But
the end result is that it's easy to install
it's
stuff.
It's easier to install stuff, yeah, because it comes as a whole.
Yeah, I think this is perhaps the biggest problem we have on the Linux desktop. I remember when I first started using Linux, and it was a version of Red Hat, and I couldn't get my head around it. You know, I installed the desktop. You sit there thinking, right, what am I going to get? I'll browse the internet for Linux software, you know, yeah. Linux games. You know, you go to a Linux game site, great, what do I click on to get the software? It's just such an alien concept from when you come from the world of Windows. And I totally sympathise with the way he felt about it. And I feel really sorry for him in the way that he's just a normal desktop user and he had to learn what a package is, what a package manager is and what it does. Yeah. And there must be a better way of doing it. We've talked about it a lot.
Well, there's been auto package, which, you know, fairly self-contained. There's been that click, zero install. But until the sizable number of distros and developers commit to it, then I think we're going
to... But they all have the same fundamental flaw. They're all rubbish. What we need is setup.exe. What we need is a file you download and double-click, and it does stuff. Now, what I'm not saying we have, you know, Windows-style MSI things or OS X-style static linking. What I'm saying is setup.exe should be essentially a bash script marked executable, which is essentially a virtual dependency system, virtual packages from Debian. You know, blah, blah, blah provides right. Flash player, blah, blah, blah provides PDF reader, blah, blah, blah. Virtual dependency. So it says, okay, double click on this. It's flash setup.exe, double click. It just says to whichever distro it's running on, Fedora, SUSE, it doesn't really matter, this person wants to install a flash player. Please sort it out. So on Ubuntu, it would be equivalent to apt get install flash player. Non-free. Right. Whatever, any version. Free. Yeah. On Fedora, it'd be yum install, da-da-da, SUSE, whatever. It would just say in its own little XML language, whatever it takes, please install this stuff.
Yeah, but that works for software in the repository. How does that work? Say a new version of ZSNES comes out, one of my favorite programs. And, you know, a load of users out there, people with their new Linux netbooks, they want to install it. I see what you're saying, but they can't just run a shell script that says go and get it from your package manager because it won't be in those repositories.
But that's exactly how SUSE solves it with its one-click installer. You press a button, it does it in, admittedly, an over-flashy way, but it adds the repo to your software sources list and installs it from there straight away.
What if there isn't a repo?
But there is. That's how it works. With a SUSE build system, it's automatically built for every version of SUSE and other distros too. You just put it in there like it is for the PPAs for Ubuntu now.
But one of the problems Preston had was that he was using the long-term support version of Ubuntu, 8.04, and he wanted OpenOffice 3. Now, presumably, it's the long-term support version. You can't install OpenOffice 3. Those packages won't be officially supported. They'll compromise the security of the system.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just not possible that he can install OpenOffice 3 in that way on his distribution.
He couldn't install the official Ubuntu version, no, unless there's a backport. And if backports are enabled in Ubuntu, you can use them.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe that is available in there. But I presume there are other repos out there that's provided. It's not terribly hard to do.
I think there is merit in SUSE's system, but it still seems more complicated than what we need. You know, it still involves repositories and having this extra information on your system. Whereas the more we strive to having software like a video game cartridge, a single thing you can move around and pick up and drop out and
I know what you're saying. I think the speedy turnaround of distros every 6 months largely eliminates the problem of I want, you know, version blah, 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 blah.
It does
blah,
for us.
Of ZSNES.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
it does for us, but not for Preston. When he goes to a website and OpenOffice, he reads OpenOffice 3 has been released on touchradar.com, heads over to the website, clicks on it. No, he's got to wait for somebody else.
I've seen this before. We're happy to install distros every 6 months, every few weeks. We're Linux geeks. But when somebody's been running Linux for 6 months, has it set up nicely, wants to get, you know, foo 3.8, you say, oh, well, you better upgrade your distro. You're saying, update your entire operating system, which can introduce other problems along the way. So I think it's a mixture of, if long-term supported releases could, there is backports in Ubuntu, so I think Ubuntu does it quite well. But it's definitely an issue. It seems to be the biggest issue that that Preston faced. Yeah.
But it wouldn't be too hard for folks to target that kind of thing, 8.04. in backports, to make 3.0 available, 3.0.1 available, all these things available to backports, because it's a fixed release for the next 5 years or so, 4 years now.
Yeah.
It's not too hard to do. It's a fixed platform. We know how it works. We know what its problems are and aren't.
But that also means that companies like Canonical sponsor those developments, that they make possible for applications to be installed with a single click. It needs to be their initiative. It's not a user initiative.
Yes, I'm saying to you now, as a world, we need setup.exe as an executable XML file, whatever it takes, I don't really care what it is, that loads some system, parses it, and does the right thing for that distro. Doesn't ever mention the word dependencies, doesn't ever mention the word repository, just goes ahead and does what you've asked.
I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Sorry. What else did he have difficulties with?
That was pretty much it. The whole thing came down to installing software and understanding the concept of dependencies.
Okay. Which is packages. Silly. You shouldn't have to understand the concept of dependencies.
Well, that sounds pretty encouraging then. If that was his only major stumbling block, then that's kind of cool.
Because yeah, you're right.
It's natural that is confusing because it is complicated.
Yeah,
it shouldn't be complicated, but it is. And if that's the only thing that he's had trouble with, then he's onto a winner.
The first thing he had to get to grips with was the understanding that there was no one version of Linux. But after that, it was package management. Because, you know, the Linux desktop works just like any other desktop. And that's a good thing. Yeah, we couldn't have said that 5 years ago.
Yes, he mentioned that he was quite surprised that all the hardware on his ThinkPad just worked.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, there is another problem with drivers and, you know, no standard format for drivers, but that's it's kind of a side issue.
So we're now halfway through this podcast, folks. Keep on listening for our discovery of the week and, of course, the open ballot. Should we make it easy to install proprietary software?
And now, drum roll, please. Oh, never mind. It's discovery of the week, where we think about cool stuff we've found on Linux, on the internet, over the last couple of weeks, since the last podcast. And Andrew has something. Go. And it's not Aird mention.
No, it's not. It's an actual real thing that's to do with software. I installed Spotify. Have you heard of Spotify?
Yes.
Yes. It's us and the whole rest of the world.
It's streaming music. Wow. It's really cool. Yeah. But there's no native Linux version of it. So you have to install Wine, which is one of those amazing recursive acronyms and stands for Wine is not an emulator.
Is it not an emulator?
I think it is an emulator. It emulates Windows. Or it's a compatibility layer if you want to be really precious about it.
They like to say wrapper, I think.
Oh, wrapper, sorry. But no, it's really easy to install. I got an error testing.
Wine is or Spotify?
Wine is. Wine's really easy. I did a bit of command line stuff. And then it gave me a couple of sound errors with ALSA. But then I just turned the machine off and turned it back on again, and it worked like magic.
Just like real Windows.
And then, you know, Spotify's just to download it, double click on it, and you're away.
And it all works.
And it all works. It just works. It's, you know, don't be afraid of installing Wine and scary-sounding things. Other recursive acronyms work too.
Like
the herd.
Have you noticed how much free software is used in Spotify? An awful lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, if you go to, I think, help credits or something, it lists them all the licenses, because they have to, obviously.
And it's Ogg Vorbis.
It's Ogg Vorbis, yeah. I think it's Libboost, too.
Oh, cool.
I think it's Boost and a few other libraries. In fact, there's lots used in there.
What's particularly nice is that if you go there with a Linux browser, it says that there isn't a native Linux version, but try Wine. Yeah. We've heard reports that it runs quite well.
Well, that's how I got the tutorial. I just did exactly what the website told me to, and it worked.
That's great. I mean, yeah.
It's a sunlit upland of things working.
And what were you last listening to on Spotify?
Ray Charles.
Great. Well, moving anti-clockwise around the Tux Radar podcast table.
That you can't see.
That you can't see, but I guarantee you it is a table, and I guarantee that we are moving anti-clockwise. My discovery of the week is something called Go Big. And this is, I'm going to say this like Steve Jobs, this is the world's biggest program launcher.
You say everything like Steve Jobs.
I know, it's a problem.
You dress like Steve Jobs.
Yes, I know.
Hang on, what's this latex peeling off your chin?
It's unbelievable.
That's where he's been.
I've been infiltrating LXF Towers. Yes, it's the world's biggest program launcher. This fills your entire screen with program launcher buttons. A bit like the interface on the EPC or Aspire 1.
Or Paul's desktop.
That sounds terrible.
The lead developer, you can tell looking at his website that he has a beef with the traditional type of start menus. You know, click start, then go into this submenu, then go into X, Y, and Z to find your program. He believes that you could just be able to minimize your windows and then you've got bam, bam, bam. All your programs, all the main programs you want to use, just move the mouse quickly and start them. A bit like the interface on the iPhone, where you just got loads of buttons. I find it quite intriguing. I'm going to use it for a few days and see if it makes me any more productive. I'm not sure yet, because I tend to use a lot of keyboard shortcuts.
But and there's lots of usability studies that say you should only have something like 7 options in front of you and things like that for the most efficient use of a computer.
Well, that's not the case on the iPhone, is it? Which is supposed to be, you know, a sterling example of usability. That's just got page after page of buttons that you can cycle through. Nobody's really complaining about that. I think people prefer that.
But that's because you can just touch them with your finger, isn't it? I mean, that's the problem. If it's this Go Big thing uses your entire screen, it's like to the top left and out to the bottom right and out to the middle left.
Well, it would be with some mice, but the way you've got the resolution set up on your mouse, you only have to move your mouse 2 millimeters to get to the other side of the screen. So
sounds like it needs a touch screen to me.
Do we have a touch screen to try it out?
Is it based on icons? Are they mainly icons, or are they just the
names? It's all icons. It's a very simple concept. I'm not saying it's brilliant. Or it's going to but it is something I found, and I'm going to use it and see, and I'll try and report back, make mention of it in the next podcast, see how I got on. Or if I get massive repetitive strain injury, then you know I won't be able to do anything. So
when you say it's, you're not saying it's brilliant.
Mm.
And this is the section of the podcast we talk about the brilliant things we found the last week or so.
Yes, yeah. But it could be brilliant.
It could be brilliant. Okay, fair enough.
It's something everybody should try, I reckon. We need to keep exploring new user interface paradigms. But
Oh, Mike. You said that word.
I did. Sorry, everybody.
I said paradigm already under Tim O'Reilly paradigm shift.
Really?
Sorry, I'm just encouraging him.
Oh, this is bad. Should we just close the podcast now?
It's been a week now since we recorded the podcast, and we're just going to catch up with Mike, see how he's getting on with his application.
Never again. Too many big icons. They're just burnt into my retina. So, yes. Paul.
Mine is a very important one, I think, because it's from me. Shutter. My discovery of the week is Shutter. It used to have the world's silliest software name, G-Scrot. it's gone now. It's just called Shutter. It's got a new icon, new version number, 0.70. It's available now to download, and it's basically a very, very fancy screenshot application. It's just beautiful. It's got a lot of things inspired from Cheese or Apple's photo booth, just done in a gnomish way. So it's got things like GVFS built in as standards. You can upload your snapshots wherever you want to. You've connected to it already. It's very, very nice. It's one of the finest screenshot tools I've seen around. A lot of things like K-Snapshot, you know, time delay or focusing this window and stuff. But you can also drag shapes across the screen to do certain bits. You can apply effects, drop shadows, jigsaws.
Can you make a sepia effect on your screenshots?
Sepia,
classic screenshots.
Yeah,
you know.
There is, yeah. It's all down there. It also has a nice little highlight thing, too. You can just draw like a circle or little arrows around things you want to point out to folks before uploading it.
You can make like annotations
on
screen.
Yeah,
that's
can.
Really cool.
Yeah,
that is cool.
It's all in there. Correct. That's a good thing. That's always a good
always
thing. Yeah, it's all in there. Plugins, PDF export, a Polaroid effect, little photos landing on the screen and stuff.
Sounds ace.
Still a little bit unwieldy. A couple too many options yet. It's looking a bit more like a KDE app than a GNOME app, perhaps.
Controversial.
You're not dissing KDE, are you?
No, not me.
Oh, that was Graham.
But I think they have to look at Cheese again, look at Photo Booth again, see the kind of things they hide. You know, you don't have to know what the mime type of the image is, folks. I think they could slim it down a little bit more, but it's looking fantastic. They've got all the hard work done, all the code's there, just now a matter of just streamlining it a little bit.
Well, that does sound good. Not all these features sound great, but surely the biggest thing is the change of name. You know, if somebody says to you, oh, how did you make this screenshot? Oh, I used a program called G-Scrot. Then nobody's going to pay any attention to you. So.
Yeah, and what was the original icon for G-Scrot?
It's now, the new icon's very nice. Shutter. It looks great. It's a little aperture thing. It's great.
So
good work to the team. Seriously, you've done a great job there.
They've had the sense to rename the program.
They have.
So GIMP must be next. It's still embarrassing to say to people, oh yeah, I use GIMP. I've got a GIMP on
my
computer.
Time, yeah.
Great. Grey am.
Okay, well, sticking with the proprietary and partisan side of things, my pick of the week is KD 4.2 on Windows.
Huh?
Just released at the end of January. They've been promising this for a long time when Qt 4 was released, which was truly cross-platform compatible. The KD team started working on KD 4, and they wanted to make it work on other operating systems, OS 10 and Windows in particular. And the 4.2 release was the first time this has happened, and I actually got a chance to try it. Well, I had a reason to try it over the weekend, and it's very, very impressive. I mean, we discussed last time whether it was worth putting developer resources into this kind of thing, but whether that's a good thing or not, it works brilliantly. It's got a great Windows installer, and it downloads all the packages from the internet. And, you know, 5-10 minutes later, you've got Dolphin, Conqueror, Copete, Amarok, everything installed on your Windows desktop, feeling like a Windows native application and applications, and it's kind of the best of the KDE desktop environment on Windows.
Does it actually replace the Windows taskbar then? Do you actually get...
No, it doesn't.
Right. The applications on
Windows, at least in this. I think that was the original intention, that the whole desktop would become KDE-erized, but no, this 4.2 release, so far as I can tell, it's just the applications. There might be the kicker applet, but I've not seen.
Yeah, because
it's a plasmoid, isn't it?
Right. As I understand it, you can replace Explorer.exe in Windows.
Yeah.
See, that's where you got like black box for Windows. You can actually chuck out the normal Windows taskbar.
I've not tried it, but just thinking it through, it's a plasmoid, the kicker thing now. So you probably could just load it up, and you know, if you get rid of the start bar or minimize it, you could replace it with the KDE one.
Yeah, or if you could just overlap it, then.
But it is handy if you're used to applications like Conqueror and Copete to use them if you have to use Windows. And Amarok, of course, is a great player, whatever the platform.
I'm not entirely sure what the fuss is, to be honest with you. I mean, it's very nice that they can do it. I'm very welcome to see more KDE in the world, honest. Really, no. but it just seems to me that we've had, you know, GIMP on Windows for ages, Banshee on Windows, Gedit on Windows. KDE's a little bit late to the game, in a way.
Yeah, well, I mean, this was Qt's fault, really, because before now, it hasn't been easy to... Before 4, it wasn't easy to port applications to other desktops. There were things missing. No, I mean things like...
That's the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah, but things like Phonon, which is the sound backend, is only in 4 and above. So if you wanted sound on Windows applications, you needed to use, you know, DirectX or Direct Media, whereas if you wanted it on Linux, you need a GStream or else or whatever. Now's the first time.
They've ported Phonon, basically, which means all the other apps.
Well, yeah, it's Qt's Phonon on Windows, so yeah, it's just you just click compile, theoretically, and as long as the KDE APIs are compatible, they'll work. Mm. And this is what they're working on, is building the compatibility into the KDE APIs so that a quick recompile will work. And this installer is the first part of it. So
awesome. Great.
Moving on now to our open ballot section. This fortnight's question is, should proprietary software be easy to install? Now, we've touched on software installation already in the programme, but I want to get away from should double-clicking on an XE or an icon be easy to the issue of proprietary software in particular. Should distros make it easy for people to get codecs that are restricted? Should we be able to watch YouTube or, you know, should they be telling us what we can and can't do with our software? Paul, why don't you start?
My answer to this one is a fairly controversial one, I think. I'm going to say no. We should not make it easy to install proprietary crapware on a free OS, because I think users need to know what kind of mess they're getting themselves into, potentially, before they go ahead and do it. So if we want to tell them, you know, Flash or NVIDIA drivers or whatever they choose, listen, before you do that, be aware, if your OS now crashes, you cannot whinge to Mark Shuttleworth. Otherwise, of course, you can call him directly.
So that's like they do with the kernel as well. A lot of kernel developers say, if you put binary drivers in, and it breaks, you sort it out.
We have no help for you here. I think readers, users need to know this. They need to be aware. The minute you switch on Flash and Firefox crashes, it's nothing to do with Mozilla. They will not help you that much.
Now, Flash does tend to crash Firefox a lot.
So that's my stance. I'm guessing you guys don't agree.
Well, no, I don't agree. I mean, to me, it's more about the overall experience. We have to have Flash. You know, you've got to have MP3 codec support. It's part of modern operating system. It's part of the online experience. And without those technologies, it's far, far inferior. If you want to, you know, without the NVIDIA proprietary graphics drivers installed and you happen to have NVIDIA hardware, then, you know, the desktop's rubbish. You can't run Compiz.
Which is an essential, you know, kind of productivity tool.
Yeah, back up, I'm not sure that's entirely true. Have you heard of the Nouveau driver?
Yes, I have.
All right, that seems
to work. It's catching up.
Yeah.
And I'd love to see it succeed, but as it stands, you still get much better performance from the NVIDIA driver.
But when all you're saying is wobbly Windows for Compiz, it's completely fine.
What I'm really talking about is the overall desktop experience that the average user is going to have. And taking a hard line on what is and isn't free is really going to make Linux unattractive to those users. It's great if you're a free software zealot, you have that choice. But if we want to see wide Linux adoption, we've got to keep up to date with what other operating systems are including.
I think we need to make it very clear to users what is free and what is not free. I think this should be easy to install, but I think it'd be nice if any time you did something like that, a massive window popped up, bugged you a little bit to say, look, software freedom is a very good thing. You're installing something here.
The reason why you've got this operating system is because of the freedom.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. But if you want, you know, we'd really rather replace these things with different technology, better, more open. But if you want to install it, go ahead. But just make it really clear so that the spirit of free software continues. You know, Stallman warned about this ages ago, and while he warns about a lot of things, I think he's got a point in saying, you know, well, hey, we've got Linux now, we've got a desktop operating system that's getting pretty good, but, you know, oh, well, let's just carry on using proprietary software. We perhaps need to go the whole hog and get everything free and open. So, yeah, make them easy to install, but make it very clear that everybody knows that this should just be a stopgap until we get full freedom.
But what would Preston Grala say if he just installed his Linux desktop after moving from Windows and his music doesn't play, his graphics card is poorly configured, you know, he can't watch YouTube?
But that's what I'm saying. It should be easy for him to get this stuff. But also, a great big window pops up and tells him this. So when he's going and writing his article, he says, I understand why there isn't MP3 support in Linux. Not because it's crap.
I think that's quite a good idea, actually, thinking it through, like a license agreement, which is what you'd expect on another operating system.
Yeah, have to be shorter. EULAs are like ridiculously long. But then, you do see it occasionally from people new to Linux. Oh, Linux can't play DVDs, it's rubbish. Linux can't play MP3s. What kind of crap operating system is this? If people knew the reasons why this isn't the case, it's not a technological reason.
Well,
it's
hold still. Linux can't play DVDs, that's true. And, you know, we can't make it play DVDs. It's not possible. We can't ever do that in the US. It's against the law.
No, not if you buy PowerDVD.
If you buy the software, fair enough. But you can't just click a button to download it.
You can probably go to PowerDVD.com and download it.
For money.
Yeah.
But it's not a click-through license agreement like what you're saying. That's not going to happen. It's not possible because of DMCA.
Not for DVDs, no.
Correct.
Yet. And the same not for Windows 32 codecs as well.
We can't fix that particular problem.
Yeah, but I don't live in the US.
It's not possible in the EU either, sadly. EUCD. I think it's an important problem that Linux is going to have to face up to really, really much and come to a conclusion about, because I'm sick of it being an issue. I think other folks are sick of it being an issue. We've got free replacements, these sorts of things. You know, for Flash, I really think Adobe are getting close to opening Flash completely, open sourcing it. I think they're sick of it.
Their Linux player?
Yeah.
It's like apparently half full of assembly code and stuff, which is pretty cool.
No, they did a rewrite for 9
right
in C. So it's a lot better now. Modern. It's better. You know, I think as Ganache gets closer and closer, they're going to have to do something. And with Silverlight actually starting to encroach it with, I presume, I don't know, allegedly some huge Microsoft marketing dollars behind it.
Well, yeah.
Adobe's going to have to do something. And it's such a tiny part of their business that, you know, the money for them comes from the creative Flash, comes from the Dreamweavers and the Photoshops and your InDesigns and your InCopy and all these sorts of things. Flash Player is nothing.
Yeah, I can't imagine if they open sourced it would cause them major problems. Because, like you say, people still go out and buy Dreamweaver. They won't say, oh, well.
Yeah, exactly. And they get all the same stuff.
Creation tools.
It's even better. More people have access to it, like Java.
Yeah.
It frees it up. They can do better with it, I think, by opening it. I mean, look at PDF. It's basically open.
True. What does the internet say?
Well, according to the internet, Paul, you're massively wrong. Almost everyone says that proprietary software should be easy to install.
False.
Well, Don Arreo, External Floppy, Ben Hall, Hugh and Stuart Ward all say yes. Don Arreo also adds that emo kids today don't realise that Morrissey started it all, so he gets, you know, kudos for that.
Kids today.
Ben Hall reckons that although he would like to be presented with a really good reason why they shouldn't be easily available, it seems to me that making basic tasks easier is generally a good aim, whether they involve proprietary components or not. As long as the user is informed about the choices they are making, that comes back to your point about, you know, choices should be informed. I don't think it's really fair on users to intentionally make unapproved choices difficult. It's paternalistic and condescending. Who would have thought condescension from Linux developers? On Tux Radar, 31 out of 32 people who said yes or no say yes. Proprietary software should be easy to install. The one dissenting voice was Pratt, who says a big no, and that's a big no in caps, as a GNU Linux user. David Fretwell says, we have to make compromises in the free software world. Without codec support, no one would buy netbooks with Linux. I myself would prefer to use a completely free system, but I watch as much YouTube as anyone else and listen to MP3s. Goes on to add, just out of interest, how many people download the MP3 version of the podcast compared with OGG? I would imagine it's at least 80% MP3, MP3 of course being proprietary. I download the MP3 because my Nokia phone doesn't support OGG. We have the figures just in. I should have drawn a pie chart to make it easier, but it looks like...
How would that make it easier?
Listeners won't be
able
to see
it. Look at this pie chart! Oh, wait, whoops!
Yeah, my fictional mental pie chart says that about two-thirds of downloads are OGGs compared with about one-third MP3s. If it's free, it's free. If it's an MP3, it's still the same top-quality podcast JPRE.
I'd just like to point out that David Fretwell says he watches as much YouTube as anybody else, but I would like to take I'd like to challenge him to that. I believe I watch more YouTube than...
You watch more Lil' Cats?
Yes.
Apparently there's a really cool video on YouTube of a man staring at you for, is it 10 minutes?
Oh, 9 minutes 59 seconds, yeah.
It's really cool.
It's awesome.
I sort of want to leave the last word with Norvegicus and Crispy Bits, who both sound really, really sensible. Norvegicus says, surely whether a distro should support proprietary software depends on the aim of that distro. If the aim of the distro is to promote only free and open source software, then of course the answer is no. But if the aim is to appeal to as many users as possible, then it's yes. I'm personally still on the fence about whether all software should be open and free. However, I'm glad I have the choice to decide. Again, it's all about choice. And Crispy Bits, that's the whole point about having a surfeit of distros. They cater for different needs. Slackware and Gentoo users will know how to create their own drivers anyway, and Herd users can compile their own homespun drivers out of bits of sheep's wool and string.
Hooray!
So what are we saying? You're supposed to say yes or no to this.
Yes. Yeah. I'm saying yes with a kind of...
Yes then?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, although you do have a good point.
So to clarify and sum up, I believe no is definitely the right answer. We should make it difficult to install because readers should understand what they're going through first, or have to click on something. Yes, I accept any instability.
I think those two premises are not mutually exclusive, but ultimately proprietary software should be easy to install.
And that brings us to the end of our podcast episode 4. I hope you enjoyed it,
folks. Oh, come on, you haven't forgotten, have you? Oh. There's one more thing.
Of course, Mike, go on. Yeah,
one,
let's hear it.
More thing,
make it good, please.
Listen to this. Raising skinny elephants is utterly boring.
I'm trying to see what the letters stand for.
Right. Well, right.
Top.
Look, if you ever feel like your Linux box is completely frozen up...
Ha!
It is, yes, yes. You got it. And you want to restart it cleanly without hitting the reset switch, which is bad news because you may lose data, like we were talking about, then what you've got to do is press and hold the Alt and the SysRQ keys. SYSRQ. Usually at the top right of the keyboard. Press and hold Alt and SysRQ, and then in order press these keys. RSEIUB. This syncs your disks, unmounts them before rebooting the machine, so that guarantees that your data will at least be intact and you won't have file system corruption. And the best way to remember those letters is raising skinny elephants is
utterly boring.
Utterly boring.
Excellent.
So you'll never forget that now.
Excellent. Do you have to hold down those keys while you're holding down Alt and SysRQ?
You hold down Alt and SysRQ and then you type in RSEIUB. Yeah.
One at a time.
One at a time, in order.
If those keys are so important, why don't they make a shortcut? Like, Alt just request X or something like that. Does it all for you?
Control and F1.
Like, shut down.
Yes.
Because there'd be no fun in that. Now you have to remember a completely
raising
silly mnemonic.
Raising skinny elephants is utterly boring. Good work, Mike.
Excellent work.
And with that, it comes to the end of our podcast episode 4. To remind you, there's a fantastic Linux format subscription deal online. tinyurl.com/podcastlxf. Prices start at just $99 for 13 issues. What a bargain. Remember, all the notes for this podcast are on the website, and you can tune in 2 weeks for more fun. And actually, it's going to be 2 weeks and 1 day, because we've got a special guest. We're holding on one extra day to get a special guest. Do not miss it. It's going to be fantastic. And if you've got time, check out the tuxradar.com in that extra day. Have a look around. We've posted some great stuff on there recently. You can take the Linux file system tour. You can read about how the kernel works. You can compile source code. And you can try some completely crazy programming languages that will melt your brain. See you in 2 weeks and one day, folks. Don't forget. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.